Hello, welcome to the APAC edition of the Syneos Health Podcast, a new series of interviews where we'll dive deep into topics of relevance in the Asia-Pacific region. I'm Robbie Chana, VP of Business Development for Asia-Pac at Syneos Health, and your host for this series. Today, I'll be joined by Sebastian Bather, President of APAC in Japan for Syneos Health, and we'll be talking about key trends in the APAC biopharmaceutical market, particularly in China and Japan. Acceleration in Asia, next on the APAC edition. Good morning, Sebastian.
Robbie, good morning. Good to be here.
Why don't we start off with talking about your role that you play in the Asia-Pacific region?
Sure. Robbie, I'm president of APAC in Japan. I've been with the organization now for 4.5 years. I've been in Asia for 30 years. I've lived or worked in 14 Asian markets, as it goes. Over the years, I've got to know a lot about the market in healthcare. I've worked in places like Bangladesh, in places like Brunei, which we don't often hear about. But I'm now based in Tokyo and focusing very much on the larger markets in the Asia-Pacific region, in particular Japan and China, but also the other big five clinical trial markets are clearly very important to us.
Sebastian, when I am talking to clients, they're looking at Asia as a destination. And quite often, there's obviously a huge desire to go to the region because of access to patient populations, disease indications. Are these sort of some of the trends that you're seeing as well in terms of your customers that you're talking to?
Yes, I think everyone in many industries has, in the last, I suppose, 15 years or so, had an acceleration of interest in growing in Asia Pacific. Why is that? I think certainly there are three or four trends that many people speak about. I'll riff those off, but talk about some of the ones that are closer to our hearts in Syneos Health in Asia. Firstly, the major trends of rising middle-class population growth, homogenization in Asia-Pacific, and growth in non-communicable diseases, particularly in areas like oncology. Very quickly on those three, I'd say that they're of particular interest to us because middle-class growth in particular is hugely important in driving healthcare development and innovation. People don't spend enough time thinking about middle-class growth in terms of what's causing it. And middle-class growth is really driven by a number of things. Disposable income, obviously, everyone is aware about, but it's also driven by urbanization and increasing education. Now, the urbanization, increasing education drivers of middle-class growth are very helpful for healthcare because, of course, it means you get a greater degree of engagement from patients and physicians, from middle-class patients than you do from emerging populations. And that's very important because we can see across the Asia region significant growth in naive patient populations for clinical trials, but also highly engaged patient populations in the commercialization space. So that's a very important driver of Asia-Pacific growth. But some other factors that are particularly interesting trends at the moment for us are significant change in regulation in China, both in the clinical and commercial space. Secondly, of rapid interest in digital enabling multi-channel engagement in the commercial space in Asia Pacific. Another one I'd call out is the increasing talent war, increasing expectations of young professionals in how they are worked with by firms that employ and develop them throughout their careers.
You speak obviously very passionately about the talent war across Asia Pacific. From your vast experience in the region, how do you think countries, companies across Asia Pacific, in terms of entering into drug development, clinical trials, how do you feel about the growth of their knowledge in running trials, commercializing assets? In Asia, are we ahead of the game?
So in aggregate, Robbie, I think we are ahead of our competitors in being able to deploy integrated solutions in Asia Pacific, particularly in the markets of China and Japan. China and Japan are the world's second and third largest markets in pharmaceuticals. So it's right that we should have strength in those markets. And I look to our key competitors, and I don't believe that they're able to assemble integrated services across clinical and commercial in the way that we can, in particular in those two markets. In the other APAC markets, we're able to provide integrated services in a less comprehensive fashion, but nevertheless integrated and leveraging our global network of services, particularly in the commercial space.
And so speaking about that bridge between the clinical and commercial activities that you've been able to discuss with your customers, what are you hearing on the ground from your client base in terms of the ability to help them commercialize their assets?
Well, the classic drivers of our support in the commercial space and clinical space are variabilization of cost, flexibility, access to insights and knowledge and experience from a firm of 23,000 people that's deployed globally. Those are very, very valid in Asia Pacific as much as anywhere else. And clients are increasingly saying to us, as we try and grow in Asia Pacific, we need more optionality. And we need to have access to deeper insights about sites, about patients, about specifics of the commercialization space. We don't have those anymore, or if they're entering the market, how do we build those in a cost-effective way? And we can help them do that, leveraging a broad array of assets. In particular, as drugs go through the development cycle towards launch, we are able to support them in their regulatory needs, in their real-world evidence needs, in consulting and launch preparation, and provide them with resources to help move through launch with things like medical science liaisons, ad board support and the like, so that they can do it in a cost-effective way.
Sebastian, that's really interesting in terms of your explanation of the explosive growth that we've seen across China and Japan. Naturally, there's a desire that these countries across Asia have a need to develop medicines for their populations. But how do we address the needs of the educational and knowledge base that is required to deliver some of these studies and access to medicines?
It's a really interesting question, Robbie, because in the last 3 or 4 years, one of the really interesting things I've seen is the growth of, in particular, Chinese companies with massive investment in developing novel drugs and wanting to take them to the global market. Now, 20 years ago, when this was going on with some of the Japanese companies, the pattern was very often to partner with another company overseas to develop a footprint and market your drugs. Today, you have a new option. The challenge of accessing knowledge, accessing resources, and getting a drug launched overseas for some of these Chinese companies is enormous. They recognize that. The standard approach of diluting the asset by partnering overseas, it works, but you now have another option. You can now partner with us, and we can help you across the life cycle deploy a drug overseas, leverage all of our expertise of 23,000 people in the US, in European markets, etc., to help commercialize drugs. Where we've won some very significant clinical trial work with Chinese companies whose names were not known 10 years ago, we're looking forward to helping commercialize as well. And that's really, really exciting. To shift that discussion slightly towards Japan, again, what I find is an interesting trend is increasing expectations from some of the big Japanese players to win greater share of growth in Asia. Now, those companies are global companies. They are significant players in the global stage, but they're trying to win disproportionate growth in South and East Asia. And that, to me, is very interesting because, again, it's something that we can help them achieve. Behind that first wave of the big Japanese clients, we're working with some of the smaller ones who are also trying to get greater share of their revenues from overseas and are using our services outside Japan to develop and commercialize their assets. And again, that's very, very exciting to see because we're actually helping some up-and-coming Japanese companies with their global strategy and achieve greater global footprint.
Thinking around some of the issues that drug companies in Asia-Pacific face as they're developing their assets in the region, you spoke earlier about the changing regulations across China in particular, and the needs to address high-quality clinical research, market access, and so on. What do you think the current trends are in terms of how drug companies are approaching their drug development needs across the regions?
So let's focus on China and Japan in answering that question, because the dynamic is very interesting across those two markets. And what's not often seen is that what has been happening in Japan in the regulatory domain is actually being mirrored in China. You don't often hear this, but this is interesting. You know, Japan has long been the world's second largest pharmaceuticals market, and companies have enjoyed privileged pricing and good access to the Japan market. But in recent years, Japan has been driving a very interesting trade-off between extracting price concessions in the mature part of the portfolio with a trade-off of stronger support for innovative portfolios being launched in the market. So it's basically the companies are no longer sustaining high prices for mature products, but they are getting faster accelerated approvals for premium pricing for innovative drugs. Now, that's well documented in Japan, but that's now happening in China as well. And where drug lag has been very significant in China, we now see a very, very rapid acceleration of the authorities wanting multinationals to bring their blockbuster drugs to China much, much faster as first wave markets, in contrast to the past where it's been much, much slower.
And that's obviously in response to the government changes in terms of developing novel drug development, right?
Yes. And the trade-off at the other side is the multinationals are being asked to reduce price and secure greater volume. Tender business is starting to appear in the commercial space. So we're seeing price pressure in line drugs, but acceleration of launch in China as a compensating factor. Actually, the same paradigm as Japan is now playing out in China. China has always moved with great speed and has marshaled resources very, very quickly to create this change, and it's causing significant disruption in China. The most interesting development to me was not just that China launched 41 drugs in 2017, which is more than the previous 3 years combined, but in 2018, listed 48 drugs that were required or requested by Chinese authorities, by multinationals, to launch in China as soon as they could. China was saying, we will give these drugs preferential approval if you bring them to market. That's unheard of. It's fantastic. That doesn't mean there's going to be an enormous increase in the number of trials happening in China. It does mean, however, that a launch and commercialization is going to create a great draw of resource needs, and we can help in many areas to support clients launch in China.
Looking at some of the trends that you're seeing across Asia Pacific in drug development, commercialization, clinical development, we've seen that there's potentially a developing need for knowledge, a developing need for the ability to run global trials, global drug launches. How are you seeing that potential gap in knowledge and that gap in the ability to help access to medicines for patients in the region?
It's a great question, Robbie, and I think it's one that particularly plays in the direction of our biopharmaceutical acceleration model, which is, as we say, this integrated solutions model that drives our strategy is driven by insights. And that's where I think we have some advantages to bring to the table. And let me use a couple of examples to illustrate that. So we have medical field teams in China, significant number of people, about 250 in total. That's quite significant. What does that mean in terms of sites, physicians, patients? Well, we educated about 500,000 patients in China in 2018 alone. That was working with about 35,000 physicians. In all the major cities in China, we've deployed these teams. Now, that gives us some insights about how patients and physicians are handling disease, how they're handling patient pathways, and how it may or may not be unique to the China context. And our ability to leverage those insights and cycle them back into the clinical domain gives us significant competitive advantage over others. And it's a very, very frequently commented on value add that we bring to clients as they think about clinical development in China. My second example I want to give you is Japan. If you think about commercial teams in Japan, day in, day out, working with physicians in detailing some of the world's best-known drugs, that again gives us a deep understanding of the market context for commercialization in Japan that many of our competitors can't bring to the table. Now, we work in oncology, we work in all the major therapy areas, cardiovascular, diabetes, etc. And whilst clients have very deep insights about their own particular drugs, because we work for a number of different clients within a different therapy area, we've got some really useful insights to bring about the therapy area, about the particular drug class, because in many cases, our teams of medical reps and MSLs will have been working on a number of different products in the portfolio over time. When I think about the project manager's team in Japan, that's order of magnitude of hundreds of years of experience of the Japan commercial market for drugs and devices. That's hugely powerful if you can unlock the insights that come from that team. That's what we're able to do.
Thinking ahead, 2019, 2020, where do we see challenges? Where do we see the industry going across Asia in commercializing assets? Because investment has been huge, growth has been huge. But how do we harness some of that into real delivery of medicines for patients in the region?
So if we tie this back to some of the trends I spoke about at the very beginning, such as middle-class growth, greater patient engagement as a result of better access to information through digital platforms, etc. If I think about the 3 to 5 year timeline, I can see a point at which our biopharmaceutical accelerator model will be deployed more comprehensively, at least in the major 5 markets of Asia: Japan, China, Korea, Taiwan, Australia, where most of our clients do the vast majority of their multi-regional trials in those five markets. We want to make sure that we can support clients into commercialization, at least in those markets, more comprehensively than we can do now. And we're investing to build capabilities. A particular example of that is that this year in Korea and Taiwan, we're launching our medical field team services with a medical science liaison academy that will run over the course of a year starting in quarter two. And as we build out our services in the region, we hope that for large multinational clients who are expecting greater share of their trials to be done in those markets, we'll be able to give them an increasing array of services to support them as they can move through to commercialization. In particular, in the services closest to launch, that's things like real-world evidence. We already have a regional team established, consulting services for launch, and medical affairs. That's where we expect to be able to help our clients more comprehensively.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Good.
Thank you for listening to the Syneos Health Podcast, the APAC edition. I'm Robbie Chana. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for another episode, you can email us at podcast@syneoshealth.com. And if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.